Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where shoppers can find items needed to treat mom this Mother's Day, from brunch favorites to sweet treats.
A few years back, the reporter Erin Alberty and her husband bought a condo just below the H Rock in Salt Lake. And like a lot of new homeowners, they had a plan for the yard. But in Utah, growing something and keeping it alive can be a test of wills. They wanted native plants, and Erin told us they thought they had a head start because right there on the hill in the backyard was a plant that looked kind of pretty, even though it had a brutish name, Myrtle Spurge.
We didn't even know what it was. It was covering the mountain. We figured it was a native plant, you know. It must belong there. And then we found out that what was carpeting our back slope was a noxious weed with caustic sap that blinds children and deer or something. And we were like, oh, no. Because that was pretty much all that was growing. So I started pulling it, and it was hard to pull. But it was fun. Every time you get one out, it's sort of like popping a zit. But then, you know, I kind of turn around, and there's a long, steep slope of naked mud behind me. I fell so many times. This is gardening that you really need a helmet for. But we did clear it. So then we kind of had to figure out the garden on our own after that. And I hadn't ever gardened before. So it was a bit of a project. We'd wanted to do all native plants, especially because we were abutting the green space, but finding them was challenging, and just to get the plants established took some pretty high-wire irrigation acts that also involved a lot of falling down the mountain, and I would say fully half of what I planted died. But a lot of things did work. One thing that we found was that there was a lot of that empty space that we didn't actually have to plant because waiting under the spurge was seed from rabbit brush and sage, things that grow native on the mountain. And that was a real delight to see after that first year, you know, some of these little baby sages popping up and anchoring the slope for us. And when those plants started volunteering, not only were they attractive and exactly what we would have wanted to plant if we'd chosen ourselves, they also started to form a barrier to the spurge seeds that would come spraying down at our house every spring. One of my favorite things about it was the birds that popped up in our yard. We started seeing stuff like black-capped chickadees and juncos and really gorgeous birds like cedar waxwings and northern flickers and western tanagers and whatnot. Hummingbirds started appearing, and so many bees, different kinds of bees too, different sizes of bees. These bumblebees would snuggle into the penstemons like they were getting into sleeping bags, and all the little silvery kind of carpenter mason bees zipping around. And it was really fun to see a habitat develop that really exceeded our expectations. The mountain wanted to grow something there. It just couldn't before. We eventually outgrew that condo and had to move. And a few years later, I came back and went hiking on the slope under the H Rock to find that so much more of it had been taken over by spurge. And when I got down to the edge of our old property line, could see that it had completely overwhelmed most of the garden. There was still some stuff that had survived, but it was basically overwhelmed. It was heartbreaking. I went back. My family was camping that weekend without me, and I found a friend and spent the weekend drinking and crying. Utah gardening is a difficult thing, and I can't imagine how people who are trying to get other people to do this instruct them, because from house to house, yard to yard, garden to garden, there's this huge diversity of plants that are native to here that can grow here, but they can't grow everywhere here. And it's great to have somebody who knows what they're talking about and has experienced these plants. Come to your house, come to your yard, come to your location and see what works. I think that the biggest thing that I learned from creating that garden is to become comfortable with failure.
Erin Alberty, Pulitzer Prize-winning Erin Alberty. She's a reporter for Axios here in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Well, it just so happens that we found someone to instruct people like Erin about how to take on the challenge that is gardening in Utah. Daryl Lindsay is back with us today. She's a sustainable landscape designer, founder of the design studio Yard Farmer. And we asked listeners to send in their questions about the spring planting season. A season, Daryl told us, will be over before you know it, so you need to get going.
We have long summers and long winters and short springs and short falls, and we don't have a lot of temperate seasons.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a general sense, I'm just thinking about how fabulous it is that it's spring and how painfully short it's going to be, because it could be 90 degrees next week. We just don't know.
Yeah.
In this great state.
Yes.
And with that, there does come a certain level of, I don't want to say anxiety because there are ways we can make our yards more resilient, but climate anxiety, even in my own front yard, you typically don't dewinterize your sprinklers until Mother's Day.
Yep.
And I'm looking out there, thank goodness it's raining right now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it hasn't rained in 2 weeks and it's 70, 80 degrees outside. I might need to pull a hose out and get some
right.
water to some of these perennials.
Well, I'd always heard that it's a good, I don't know if it was like a farmer's almanac thing or some old farmer or rancher told me, if you can wait until Memorial Day weekend mm-hmm. to water your grass, it's mm-hmm. going to be healthier or something like that. And I don't know if that works in the current sort of climate moment, or does it?
You still typically want to wait till at least Mother's Day.
Yeah.
The grass is going to be fine. I was more so worried about these little tender perennials that I got in the ground last fall that you would typically want water to once a week right now or something because they're still young. But normally it would be raining right now, and right. I would just start doing that once a week once I turn the sprinklers on.
April showers. It's supposed to be like that, right?
You're supposed to have April showers.
Yeah.
But we have short springs and unpredictable springs no matter what.
Right.
When you ask what I'm thinking about right now, I'm sort of just waiting to see what kind of year and what kind of summer we're going to have. Mm. A couple of seasons ago, I think 3 summers ago, we had 100-degree days first week of June.
Yeah.
It was the first week of June. It was 102, 103. And clients that I was trying to help them get gardens in the ground, those plants were so stressed and it was really difficult. And so then that whole year, I was telling the following year's clients, like, we got to get the plants in by May. We have to. It's going to be too stressful to wait. And then it was 70 degrees on the 4th of July for a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, I can't predict the weather. I'm not a climate scientist, but I'm looking at the temperatures and the snow year that we had, and I'm worried we're headed into another hot, dry stretch.
Yeah.
And we're going to need to start thinking about water conservation again.
You know, I had never thought about the fact that short springs, a short fall is distinctive to this place.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's true. And so that means what for the spring? Make the most of this little contained period?
Yeah, I mean, you want to get plants in the ground, be it a drought-tolerant native plant or just, you know, grandma's lilac or what have you. You
right.
want to get them in the ground before it's stressful.
Yeah,
the ground needs to be workable, and sometimes we have a foot of snow halfway through April, so it's a tricky, unpredictable time to navigate. But as soon as it starts to be 90 degrees, 100 degrees outside, it's really difficult to keep young plants alive. So
yeah.
that can be stressful for people installing new gardens and landscapes.
Can we talk about pollinators? You put out a post a few weeks ago that I loved because it gave me an excuse not to do my yard work yet. Because you said, people, hold off. I'm guessing we don't need to hold off now, but you were saying, hold off because you want to protect the pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people might know what that means, and I think bees. And maybe it's just bees, but what do you mean by pollinators? How do we protect them? Like, let's talk about pollinators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot going on with bees right now. Typically, I would go on a soapbox adjacent tangent about how honeybees don't need our help, and it's all about our native bees, bumblebees and squash bees and mason bees and carpenter bees. There's so many types of bees.
Yeah.
And those are typically more solitary ground nesting bees rather than swarming or hiving bees.
Right.
And they nest in the hollow stems of plants, you know, those purple cone flowers. Leave them up until it warms up in the spring. They might look a little thatchy and a little dry, but there are pollinators sleeping in there. I'd rather you not put it through a leaf chipper
right
in the wintertime. Now it's fine. They're out. They're
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
But honeybees are having a hard time too right now because of climate change, and we've seen a lot of hive loss as well. So really, all around, we've got to be nicer to the bees.
When I walk around the neighborhood, at least certainly a week ago or so when things were really blooming, it didn't seem like there were any – now, I don't know if this was just my neighborhood or whatever, but it didn't seem like – I'm like, where are the bees? I can usually hear the buzzing of the bees in that crabapple tree in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Is that an indicator in some way?
I don't have the science this year. There are amazing scientists right now who are tracking bee populations and when they're up and when they're down. So I don't know if this year specifically we're seeing them distinctly lower than other years. But there are a lot of practices that homeowners do on a collective scale. So we're talking about, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of homes here in the valley where we're making it really hard for bees to thrive.
Yeah.
We're clearing everything out. We're not creating habitat for them to hibernate. We're spraying chemicals. Every time you spray a broadleaf herbicide or a fungicide or an insecticide, you are harming the soil. You're harming pollinators. Those are really tough conditions for native bees and all bees to thrive in.
You want to say something about Joe Wilson's book, Bees in Your Backyard?
It's the best. Joe Wilson is one of my design clients. We helped design his whole landscape, and he happens to be a bee scientist. And that was a real good day in the office when I got on for an initial consultation to be like, let's talk about pollinators and gardens. And he's like, well, actually, I literally wrote the book on it. Yeah. I went to our first client kickoff meeting, and he handed me a book. He's like, hello, I wrote this. It's called Bees in Your Backyard. And it's really, you just could learn about all of North America's native bees, and most of them are around. And ever since I did that walkthrough with him, I notice more the telltale signs of those bees, the little holes that you see where they've nested. Mm. And I think they might literally be air holes. That's what they're breathing up through.
Wow. What about water? Are we supposed to sort of set aside like bee baths?
Is that 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. So pollinator baths are different than bird baths in that you need to create landing pads for them. Yeah. So a really shallow dish with some aquarium pebbles in it, or even just pebbles from your yard and places where a bee could land safely and drink. And you'll find butterflies, hummingbirds, birds, bees, ladybugs. They'll all come and drink from that, especially on hot days. Putting it in the shade so that the water doesn't evaporate too quickly.
Yeah.
And if you're listening to this and you're in Utah, you do not have to worry about mosquitoes. It's going to be less than 24 hours in which a bee bath amount of water, an inch of water, will evaporate. There's just not going to be a mosquito issue. But top it up every day because they're stressed. And I also I want to advocate for wasps for a second.
Hmm.
Everybody,
people hate wasps.
They hate wasps. The wasps are hungry and thirsty. That's the only reason they're being annoying to you. They're actually incredible pollinators, and they're very good friends in the garden because they eat aphids. They eat cabbage moth larvae. They eat a bunch of pests that would make your life as a gardener difficult. And they pollinate plants just as much as a bee does. If they have native flowering plants, nectar to eat and water to drink, they will leave you alone. Like when I first moved into my house and we just had a bunch of bluegrass going up to some chain link fence, it was not a great look.
Yeah.
We couldn't eat outside. You know, you'd have your burgers and hot dogs and stuff outside and there'd be bees and wasps swarming.
Yeah.
They were hungry and thirsty, and we smelled like sweat and had food. I could be elbow deep in my garden now with bees and wasps everywhere, and they do not care that I'm there because they have enough to keep them busy.
Okay. I think let's go to some questions here. And this is where I think a lot of people are thinking this time of year where to start. Ashlyn Gonzalez sent this question. This is our first year planting a garden in Salt Lake City. She put an exclamation point there. She's apparently very excited. What are the top must-do items that we may not know about to have a successful garden here?
It depends on what we're planting in, but let's say you already have a bed that's prepared. You've cleared out an area. You've put some sort of edge in so that you have a distinct separation between your lawn and this area that you're going to be planting out as a garden. The tips I would offer you would be to aim for 100%, or if it's easier to think about it, maybe even more than 100% plant coverage in that bed, so that a year, 2 years down the line, when those plants reach maturity, you don't see the soil or the mulch anymore, so that you don't constantly have to be topping up your mulch every year and weeding the beds. That plant coverage, where you don't see the dirt, you don't see the mulch, is actually – it becomes a living mulch where it shades out the soil and prevents other weeds from coming in. If you want that bed to look a little more intentional and a little neater, because there is a certain neat aesthetic to having – you know, mulch and a petunia and a daisy and a petunia and a daisy and a line, but you still want that native pollinator habitat and lower work, lower water, I would really rely on color blocking there, where you use an edge to kind of give you framing. Maybe you plant a taller plant in the center that can be a focal point, and then you plant three of something yellow and three of something purple and three grasses that are a little more neutral. And don't just go glitter confetti with it where you're packing in. A bunch of different things all at once.
You know what I like about your sort of attitude is that you acknowledge there are people out there, as you just were saying, who have a sort of – and maybe it came from their parents or another time. They have a neater aesthetic. Some are fine to get a handful of, you know, wildflowers and just throw them out there and see what happens. Some people want something a little neater, and you're cool with that. Right?
Yeah. I would prefer to do it in a way that's still low maintenance and low water and, in general, better for the environment than petunia, daisy, petunia, daisy.
Right.
But for example, if we were designing a yard
– But you can be responsible and be neat.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it comes down to framing, focal point, texture, color. If I were to plant one of every single native plant I picked up at the nursery, it's going to look like, for lack of a better word, glitter confetti. It's going to be very chaotic.
Yeah.
And when somebody wants to look like they live in the Hansel and Gretel witch forest cottage thing, that's fine. That's great.
Right.
But let's say you live in a modern house, or you just happen to have an aesthetic that likes clean lines and you don't want a lot of chaos, maybe we're planting only ornamental grasses and things with leafy green foliage. So we're keeping the color palette, three different types of greens and maybe some white in there. But we're still doing that 100% plant coverage thing. Or maybe we're really going nuts before we even think about plants with the hardscaping, and we're doing some big steel edging or something to provide some structure and some framing so that the brain can kind of make sense of a space. And then once you have like steel, hard, clean lines, you can get a little wilder inside. And the brain says, that's supposed to be there. That's fine.
Yeah.
So there's ways to balance it.
All right. Let's talk about natives. This comes from Zach. Hopefully it's not too late for you, Zach. He wants to know, what are some good early flowering Utah native plants?
That's a great question. Because right now we're finally starting to get some more mid-spring blooms, but early, early spring, April, it's pretty limited out there. And you probably notice that too when you're walking around. You see sort of dormant grass and not a lot going on.
Yeah.
So there's a couple ways to bring interest in through the winter. But to directly – sorry, let me directly answer Zach's question. Phloxes are going to be your best friend. Our native Utah phloxes are cushion phlox and moss phlox. But I would take a creeping phlox. I'd take a woodland phlox. Most nurseries have them, and you've probably seen them. They're like the dime-size pink, blue, and white little flowers. Some are lower growing. Some are mid-size. Those start in sometimes even late March if it's warm enough and are still blooming now. So it's a great – thing to have for April interest. Prairie smoke avens is a lesser known native plant. It likes a little more shade, but if you have sort of a woodland border, that's blooming at the same time. But I also like to bring in some evergreen interest from winter time so that you're not just waiting for things to start blooming. So having some dwarf evergreens, like we've got really cool smaller cultivars of pinyon pines that are great, or mock oranges or sumacs or something that hold onto their leaves longer through the winter. And then you put some phloxes and some prairie smoke avens in front, and you've got a pretty cute April border.
Lewis wants to know, is it too late to expect anything from wildflower seeds?
No, it's not too late.
Okay.
You will want to make sure that if you're buying a wildflower seed right now that it has been cold stratified. Some seeds don't need to be cold stratified, but some do. Basically what that means is that the seeds believe that winter happened to it. So if it was sitting in a warehouse at 70 degrees the whole time, they don't know that winter took place. And a lot of them need that to germinate. So you would just verify with whatever source you're buying seeds from that they had already been cold stratified and kept chilled for a period of time.
Daryl Lindsay, she's the founder of Yard Farmer. It's a sustainable design studio. If you want to follow her, we have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where shoppers can find items needed to treat mom this Mother's Day, from brunch favorites to sweet treats.
Today in the program, Daryl Lindsay is back with us. She's a sustainable landscape designer and a social media influencer for people who want to grow things here in the West. Daryl says spring in Utah is short, so she's with us answering questions about getting your yard and garden ready for the heat of the summer. We have in the past, and this is something that comes up a lot, it's the grass conversation, the lawn. And we've talked about it a bit, but how are you thinking about it now? By the way, can people still take your class?
Of course.
Okay. Mention it.
Thank you. Because, thank you for the plug, Dr. Fabrizio.
Well,
Thank you.
I took this class, so I happen to know. But to say something about that, because I think this will be helpful for – and we'll put a link to this, by the way, on our website.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yes, I did do a webinar last year, and I did see that you attended, which I appreciate, called Goodbye Grass, which was helping people transition some or all of their lawns from grass to native landscape. I think what you're asking is my opinion on if lawn should stay or go. And
you can say whatever you want. We've talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of know where you are. You're like, look, if you have kids and if you have a dog, you may do some grass. You don't feel guilty about it necessarily, but maybe use the right stuff or be – and sometimes you can – I don't know. The conversation I'm hearing a lot is – and I'm seeing a bit more – is clover.
Mm. Lawn alternatives.
Yeah.
So clover on its own is not my favorite lawn alternative, just a pure straight clover lawn. I find that it's actually difficult to keep it from getting lumpy and bumpy. Mm. The irrigation water will kind of rut the soil out underneath easier, and I don't think it holds up to foot traffic that well. I do love a clover-grass mix. Mm. Grass and clover actually do have a symbiotic relationship with each other. We have studies on this that they both perform better when they are planted together, and that's great news for people who are on tighter budgets too, because if you have existing bluegrass, you could overseed it with clover and make your yard a little more resilient and drought tolerant without having to go scorched earth and start from scratch, which is great. The lawn alternative question, the question on if you should scrape everything and start from scratch with a new drought tolerant lawn, if you should shrink your lawn, it really comes down to your existing conditions. There are times where I walk into a landscape design site and there's a big tree on the western side of the property, and the grass directly under it looks great. And I'm like, I'm not going to make you demo all of this grass that honestly doesn't take that much work and water to keep really nice.
Yeah.
But the stuff that's 50 feet over in full sun that is currently brown and thatchy and lumpy, let's rip that grass out and just convert that to a drought-tolerant native landscape with some pathways through it. So there's an option where you just go outside and you look. Mm. And you just pay attention. Where is it easier to keep stuff green and where is it harder? And you select the lawn you're going to keep, the shape that you're going to keep based off of what your conditions are already telling you. If your whole yard is full sun, then I think you have an opportunity here to maybe just demo the existing Kentucky bluegrass, which really isn't ideal for our climate,
yeah,
and go over to a buffalo grass that's native. We have hybrid Bermuda grasses now that are really interesting, low growing, low maintenance, low water, all of those things. But they need full, capital F, full sun.
Wow.
And so sometimes a client will ask me, like, can I put buffalo grass here? I want to save a lot of water. And I'm looking up at that giant tree.
Yeah.
I'm like, you don't need it.
Yeah.
Just rip out the grass over here that's dead, and the lawn here is going to take once every 10 days, water it for 20, 30 minutes in the summer. It's going to be okay.
Should we be cultivating shade?
That is a great question. Yes, absolutely. One of the first things I look at is, are there sources of shade to the south, the southwest, the west, and the northwest? Hmm. Basically, that whole half of the spectrum, but especially the west and northwest, because that's where the sun sets in July when being outside at 6 p.m. ruins all of our lives. We want that shade. And if it's possible to just get a tree in the ground, even if you're not ready to do any other landscaping for a couple of years, just to get a jump start, that would be an excellent place to put it.
Here's a question from Palma, who writes, I'm interested in container gardening on a small west-facing balcony in Salt Lake City. Now, this is a damn good question for a lot of people as you're seeing more and more apartments pop up in the city. Let me continue her question. Like many people living in high-density housing here, my balcony gets intense afternoon sun and heat, especially obviously during the summer. I've had some luck, she says, with self-watering containers, but every year I invest a lot of money in trying to make my small outdoor space thrive. So help Palma and other people out. She's looking for strategies and plant selections. What would you say?
Amazing. I love this. And I think container gardening needs to be done more, whether you live in a townhouse or an apartment, or even if you have a yard, there's real estate on your patio to just get stuff blooming, help the pollinators out,
yeah,
and also just enjoy it because it's fun.
Yeah.
If it is a container, so it's above ground and it's west facing, that means that the roots are going to be cooking a little bit because they're not insulated by the soil if they were planted in ground. So planting specifically very heat tolerant, very drought tolerant plants, and then coming up with some sort of strategy to stay relatively consistent with watering is going to be necessary. A self-watering container maybe works. There are also these things called ollas that are essentially sort of terracotta vases that you can bury in your container with a little neck that sticks up above the soil line, and you can just fill that up as sort of a slow-release drip system.
Yeah.
You'd want to water much more often, two or three times more often, a container than you would a plant in the ground because there's no insulation there. So for her specifically, grasses and flowering perennials in Utah that are prairie grasses that are used to baking in the sun, things like blue grandma grass or little blue stem as a maybe the backdrop plant, and then putting some flowering perennials that are really heat tolerant in there. Ones that are coming to mind are scarlet globe mallow, maybe yarrow, that'll get a little big, but honestly great. Something else to know, if and when anything ever looks a little dry, a little sad in that container, these native grasses and flowering perennials don't die when they get too dry and too hot. They just go dormant.
Mm.
And I've had...
So I don't actually, yank them out.
Don't yank them out.
Yeah.
Just cut back anything that gets woody and thatchy,
right,
and start watering it again, and you're going to notice new green growth pretty quick.
We could talk forever about rainwater.
100%.
Let me ask you one question that comes from Shreya. Or Shariah. She asks, you talk a lot about digging swales. When Daryl is looking at a flat landscape, what helps her decide where to put a new swale?
Great
Do you love question. That
question? I love the question. First off, when I say we're digging a swale, what I mean is we're digging a flower bed that is slightly lower than the other flower beds, and we're making sure your downspout water is pointed at that flower bed.
Awesome.
And if you put native drought-tolerant plants in that slightly depressed flower bed, they probably don't need much supplemental irrigation. That's the idea. Hmm. And we've been able to design yards where maybe we're watering once a month in July, once a month in August, but otherwise we don't need supplemental irrigation because the rain is doing the work and the watering for us. When I'm deciding where to put a swale, it really is thinking about the design constraints of the area because there are things like where utility lines are, where existing patios, hardscaping is, and also the distance to the house because I'm not really trying to sink water into a swale closer than 10 feet away from the foundation because if we're having massive storm events, I don't want that water to be so close to the basement or the foundation of the home. So first off, before I even think about the swales, I'm making sure that the functional needs of the design, like do we need a patio for a dining table? And then if that patio extends more than 10 feet off the back of the house, anywhere beyond that, the swale can go.
Right.
So I'm making sure it's not directly under a tree, so I'm not digging tender roots of a tree, making sure I'm not digging where a gas line is or your Google Fiber. So we're sort of just using the constraints to make those decisions.
Let's shift to, I guess, invasives, or at least this. What do you know about myrtle spurge? Some people will know exactly what you're talking about. Maybe we should say what it is.
Existence.
Yeah, yeah.
Myrtle spurge is an invasive weed that also happens to be incredibly toxic, and if you touch it, it'll give you a terrible burning sensation, rash. So it's just nasty all around, and it's a really terrible invasive taking over. I see it in residential yards all the time. It's taking over the slopes, in the foothills. If you see it in your yard, we're going to want to have gloves on when we're removing it, and we want to get it out of there as soon as possible. There are a lot of nuances to that that I don't know if we have time to get into, but consulting a landscaping professional to see what the right course of action is for your unique conditions, because sometimes it's excavating and digging things out big time. Sometimes it's hand digging. Sometimes herbicides kind of have to happen if there's no way around it.
Because this stuff is really sturdy.
Yeah. The three banes of my existence in the Salt Lake Valley are myrtle spurge, white top, and bindweed.
Bindweed.
And they're nasty, nasty, nasty.
Well, this is a question. This also comes from Emily. How can we responsibly change out plants to be more water friendly without introducing new problems? Emily's, her neighborhood's outside of Mill Creek, and she's started talking about the myrtle spurge, which she drives her crazy, but it's an escaped landscaping plant is how she described spurge. And so that's what she wants to know is how do you change out these plants to be more water friendly, but as, again, not introducing new problems? That's
right.
The question.
Well, and one thing that weeds and invasives love is disturbed soil.
Yeah.
And traditional gardening, the cycle of traditional gardening, which I could really go on a whole rampage about, sort of lives in the world of disturbed soil. Because if you imagine that bed we sort of made up at the beginning of this conversation with the petunia and the daisy and the petunia and the daisy, that soil's constantly being weeded. We're yanking stuff up. We're disturbing the soil. And we're not allowing plants to come in and stabilize and cover that soil. And a weed, in our industry, we also call it a pioneer species because it comes in after a disturbance, be that a gardener weeding, a gardener tilling, spraying Roundup, or in a more macro nature sense, wildfire, flood, et cetera. Those pioneer species come in as the first step of ecosystem succession where they're like, hold on, this soil looks like it really could use some help. Let me get in here and lock it up so it doesn't erode. And so your crabgrass and your bindweed and even your myrtle spurge, although I have many negative feelings about it, they kind of think they're doing you a favor. They are there to serve an ecological purpose. And so when we're talking about swapping out plants and not introducing more problems, minimizing soil disturbance, or at the very least having a plan for if you do need to excavate or till or aggressively pull plants out of the ground, what are we putting back in its place as quickly as possible so that good native pollinator-supporting low-water plants can be doing that stabilization instead of crabgrass and myrtle spurge and bindweed.
So weeds are driving Michael crazy, and he wants to know a best way to control them without taking over my lawn. And here's some of his questions. One of them is, I love this, Do I have to pick them by hand? What about the dreaded Star of Bethlehem, which I don't know what that is. You can tell us. Do I have to tear up my lawn to get rid of it? Can I spot remove patches of it to keep it at bay? And then another question that Shariah also asked is, like, how do you kill weeds responsibly?
Okay, so there – weeds in a lawn is its own thing. I'll talk about that first because it seems like that's Michael's issue.
Yeah.
Couple ways to go about it. If your lawn is mostly weeds at this point, then we are probably going to start from scratch. Mm. So we would excavate so that we can get the lumps, the bumps, all of those weed rhizomes out. And then we would decide if we want to somehow treat the soil. I prefer not to spray herbicides if I can get away with it for all of the pollinator reasons that we talked about.
Right.
There's something you can do called solarization where once we scrape and throw away all of the weeds, you can put plastic down and basically cook your soil. Mm. And then, you know, we'd add a little compost, a little lawn leveling mix, put some new sod down. And from there, we'd start just your general ongoing weed maintenance and management. If we're talking about some clumps of Star of Bethlehem, which is a very annoying invasive weed in Utah, some clumps of Star of Bethlehem or some dandelions or what have you, I think more – this might not be the answer they want to hear, but it's sort of a 1-2 punch of spot managing it.
So, yes, you do have to pull them out by your hand.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Because the other answer is – or the other part of my answer is maybe not what they want to hear, which is that we could also just be okay with a slightly more biodiverse lawn. And maybe we overseed with clover, and then when you mow and you weed whack, you don't really notice the extra textures coming in from the mowed dandelion leaves or the mowed Star of Bethlehem.
Yeah.
Now, with those weeds, both dandelions and Star of Bethlehem, and all of the other ones that you'll find growing and popping up in a lawn, the flowers themselves are what will go to seed and then make those things spread and double, triple exponentially. So the minute you see those in your lawn flowering, you could just go out and weed whack them so that flower can't go to seed. And now you have twice as many, three times as many weeds in the lawn. And then if we're just sort of kind of mitigating it, and then maybe we throw some clover seed down into your existing grass and you just got a little more biodiversity in there and it's fine. It's fine.
It seems like part of the message might be cool without perfection, or just maybe get used to something more diverse because it's kind of maybe more interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we don't need our lawns to be golf courses. I have said this many times. We even referenced it earlier in this conversation where I'm pro lawn because I'm pro dogs playing fetch and kids running around.
Yeah.
Kids can run around on a lawn with some mowed dandelions in it. I just don't care about that. But I do think when you see those things pop up, if you want to prevent their multiplication and their spread, we just need to get those flowers mowed as quickly as possible.
Because those charming images of little kids blowing on the dandelion thing, they're just basically germinating seeds.
You are just spreading more dandelions.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
It's Daryl Lindsay. She's a sustainable landscape designer, founder of Yard Farmer, an ecological design studio. We'll put a link to her social media account and everything else she does on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
Back to our conversation with the yard farmer, Daryl Lindsay. We're talking about plants and other stuff to keep in mind for the beginning of the growing season. Okay, Benjamin, our producer, asks, do you recommend putting cardboard and or straw on the walking paths between garden rows?
Oh, very interesting. Okay, so garden rows, like we've got our edible plants in the ground. I do recommend anything that isn't gravel, basically.
Huh.
And so this will depend on your aesthetic, your vision, your budget. But you could put cardboard down and just throw some wood mulch on top, maybe with some stepping stones. You could grow a living ground cover as a walkway. That would be really sweet and beautiful. But your gravel's just going to attract a whole bunch of weeds and you're going to be in a maintenance nightmare the whole time.
It attracts heat too, right? Gravel?
Yeah. It's hot. It's ugly. It's hard to get debris out of it when it blows in. Trying to get little broken down leaves out of gravel is my personal version of hell. So I'd much rather have cute little stepping stones and like a living ground cover or something. But cardboard just to suppress whatever's growing underneath and some wood chips to walk on if we're just thinking about a practical area to grow some squash, I think that's great.
Do you I don't know if you want to point out particular shops or places, but there was a question from Miranda who asked, which local Utah shops sell native plants?
Great question. Twin Pines Nursery in Sandy has a really great native selection. And I would be remiss not to reference Cache Valley Native Plants. And they're a 100% native nursery up in Logan, but they do deliver down to Salt Lake quite often.
Okay, great. Ashlyn wants to know, how do you control pests like mice and rats and raccoons around your compost?
Great question. When we live in urban environments and we want to compost, you may attract certain vermin and pests to those compost bins because we have organic matter breaking down. My recommendation is to have a compost bin that is like a standard tumbler or something that's elevated off the ground because most of those pests are agoraphobic and they're not going to be climbing up into. So have a small one just right off the back door so that you can throw your banana peel and your coffee grounds and shredded paper or whatever directly into that. But when that's full, we can wheelbarrow those contents over to regular compost bin in the very, very, very back corner. And maybe we've reinforced it with some hardware cloth to help hopefully keep pests out.
Yeah.
But if something does get into there, it's not right up on your back door or the side of your garage or a place where that would maybe feel icky to have them.
Because that seems inevitable, these creatures,
in
right?
In an urban environment, and you're putting all of this organic matter out, like they're going to look for food and habitat. So it might happen. I just don't want it to be on my porch. So I have a little compost tumbler that my daily trip back and forth from the kitchen happens that is elevated off of the ground just in a little plastic tumbler. And then the three-bin system is way in the back corner.
I love this question because a lot of us have had apricot trees in our yards. Mm-hmm. Rebecca does. Rebecca has, as she says, a large apricot tree that's on its last legs. And I want to start another tree from the seeds of this tree. What's a good way to do that? Just putting a seed in dirt doesn't seem to work, she says. And is that even possible? The tree is likely over 100 years old.
Oh, that's so special. There are a couple of answers for you, but I think seeds are probably not the right solution. Yeah. I would much rather you take a cutting from the actual biomass, a branch, a small, soft branch, and then we would propagate new roots off of that cutting. I am not an expert in grafting and propagation, but if it is a 100-year-old apricot tree, I think first I would get a good certified arborist who specializes in saving trees over there to see what we can do to extend the life of the tree. Because maybe we could get the apricot's babies, one or two grandchildren or what have you, started for a few years before we have to say goodbye to the beautiful ancient tree.
What should people know about mulch?
What should they know about mulch? Use it.
Use it. Okay.
Use it. Yes. So like I said before, I prefer plants to become a living mulch over time.
Yeah.
So I don't really love the using wood chips as landscaping thing where we have to buy it every single year and top it up every single year. Mm. But we need something on our soil if we're not having grass there. If I'm planting a native perennial landscape, we need something in between those plants that's going to help suppress weeds and keep the moisture in the soil. So I want 2 or 3 solid inches of a natural wood mulch. Preferably not even something that's dyed, because really that's designed to be the petunia daisy mulch.
Wait, so where do you get it? Do you buy natural wood mulch?
Yeah, sure do.
Okay.
From arborists, from nurseries. A natural forest blend is a standard name you can look up to find something. Oh, man, I want to gatekeep this because I don't want to sell my clients out of it, but I won't. Natural forest blend from Biograss Farms is the mulch that we use most often, and it's gorgeous. It's a beautiful size, beautiful color, and it hasn't been heated and treated and dyed, so there's still beneficial microbial activity happening in that mulch, and that helps out the soil.
I want to ask about, all right, there's a kind of a question about where you think we might be in terms of our, I don't know how to put this, cultural awareness. It comes from Emily. She first of all, she just wants to mention that my husband has a beautiful yard. It is his baby. We've taken out all of our lawn. We've put in more water-friendly things, but we're outliers. How long, she asks, before this mindset changes in Utah and we're all moving to less turf or more planting for what's appropriate here? Are you seeing any sort of cultural shifts out there?
I think there is a significant cultural shift happening collectively right now, but it's always going to be slow and steady. There are going to be people who want to hold on to a very specific type of landscaping and a type of look. Yeah. But I think especially as drought becomes more and more prevalent, as people are paying attention to what's happening with the Great Salt Lake, and as actual restrictions are coming into place, water restrictions, and in some case, full shutoff for our homeowners on the Wasatch Front on secondary water, where they just say, there's no more.
Yeah.
Remember a couple years ago when I said we had that 100-degree June? I had several clients who hired me towards the end of the summer because their water got shut off and they lost 100% of their landscaping.
Wow.
And so they wanted to switch over to a native drought-tolerant landscape. So if that were to ever happen again, they wouldn't lose all of their investment, because that was tragic to see a once beautiful yard go to basically nothing because there was truly just no water accessible anymore. And that's where we use rainwater harvesting. We use those drought-tolerant native plants. I think in the case of this question, for somebody who's already kind of walking the walk but feels like an outlier still, it's about talking about it, bragging about it even, and getting your neighbors excited. We have seen that as soon as one native landscape appears in a neighborhood, others will start popping up because that example needs to be set. So have a cute sign that says this is for the pollinators so that anybody who wants to shame you about your native yard has to feel bad that they hate pollinators.
Yeah.
Talk to people about it and get them excited.
Okay. Last question. And this may – I don't want to put you on the spot, but Rachel wants to know books or resource recommendations for learning about traditional landscaping styles. Are there some go-to resources, books in particular, to check out?
Absolutely.
We mentioned Joe Wilson's book before,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's sort of one.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I have that book and more. I can send you a link so that we can put it here where people can access it. But I have a curated list of books that I think are really helpful. If you want something that's more aesthetic inspiration, there's a really gorgeous coffee table book called Under Western Skies, where it's all Rocky Mountains and further west native landscapes with really distinct visual features and senses of place. And it's just real pretty to look at.
Right.
So if you're looking for that kind of thing, I would start there. If you're looking for more introductory resources about why native landscaping matters and why we need to do these things and how to get started, Douglas Tallamy, who's been sort of pioneering the using your own residential landscape as a form of conservation, that movement. He has many books about this. Nature's Best Hope is a great introduction to the concepts. And then he actually has a sort of landscaping how-to guide called The Living Landscape as well, which I think is great.
Okay. Any final pep talk for the people who are just venturing out?
Let's say you look out your window from your house and you just have grass.
Yeah.
Choose the shape for your lawn that is easy, efficient, simple. Don't worry about cutting in all of these wiggly, squiggly flower beds that are going to give you a lot of overwhelm as far as what to put there. Think of your yard right now as if it's a big rectangle. Draw out the shape for the smaller rectangle that's going to be easy to mow, easy to water, easy to manage. The flower beds can just exist on the outside of that shape. And then I would focus on getting some big low maintenance shrubs in there, getting some beautiful native flowers. I don't know if this is a pep talk, Doug.
It seems peppy. What you're saying is
keep it simple.
Okay.
I'm saying keep it simple. I think sometimes people get overwhelmed because yards are complicated. There's a lot of different functions they need to serve, both from how you're going to use them, and also the right light and the right water. So start simple and just shrink the lawn to a shape that's going to be easy and go from there.
It's the perfect pep talk. Daryl Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you.
Daryl Lindsay, she's a sustainable landscape designer, founder of Yard Farmer, an ecological design studio. You can catch her posts on TikTok and Instagram at yardfarmer.co. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1, Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.